My name is Doris Meissner. I'm a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, and I and MPI are very pleased to host the release today of a report by the Women's Refugee Commission, which you have before you, called Detained or Deported, What About My Children? Michelle and I were just talking about this report. It really, it's very nicely done. So I am pleased that we are able to have copies for you, and those of you who still read things on paper rather than the internet, we're pleased to send you home with one or several if you'd like to take some along. The backdrop for this discussion, I think, is to say a couple things. Immigration, of course, is a fractious, unsettled issue in our public debate, certainly in our broader national policies and legislation. But I think it's also fair to say that there is strong support and political agreement across parties in the Congress and in public opinion on two aspects of immigration. One is border enforcement and border security, and the other is deportation. So that to be serious about immigration and immigration policy, one must grapple with those issues. And this issue of deportation can be particularly uncomfortable and difficult to talk about and to work on. So I am really pleased to be able to say today and have the opportunity to have this discussion of a report that goes at the issues and engages them in a very practical and a very constructive way, a way that we really haven't seen before. So we're going to hear about that from the panel. We're going to have presentations from the people who are up here, and then we'll have some time for your questions and for discussion. Our panelists are first on my left, Michelle Brain. Then we're going to go to Andrew Strait, and then to, I think that's the order, yeah, and then to Emily. And each of them are going to make some short presentations. We were going to have another speaker, Randy Capps, talk about some work that MPI is doing on these issues that is not yet ready, but that will be interesting when it's released. I must say that in the nature of the topic that we're talking about today, he is the primary caretaker for his children this week, and there was a family emergency, and he got called away about a half an hour ago. So it brings home in the most direct possible way these issues of parents and children and how we all live our day-to-day lives and the kinds of things that we need to confront and grapple with on many, many levels. One of Randy's colleagues and our colleague, Sarah Hooker, is here in the audience, and she has a couple of numbers, not a polished presentation, but a couple of numbers that are interesting from that research, and we'll give her a chance to contribute that toward the end of the panel. Then we're going to finally close with some also more recent news, and that is that Emily will bring us up to date on a couple of legislative developments in the Congress as we speak. So that's our program. That's our flow of show for this afternoon. And with that, I'm going to turn to Michelle.
Thank you, Doris. We first came across this issue more than 5 years ago in visiting detention facilities. So as many of you may know, the Women's Commission for a long time has visited facilities that are detaining migrants and spoken to people about the conditions of detention and what their concerns are. And we began hearing from some of the people who were detained, primarily the women to start with, about concerns with their children. And we were actually at the time specifically looking at medical care issues. And as more and more women started saying, well, the medical care is a problem, or this is a problem, but what I'm really worried about is I don't know where my children are. And I can tell you that as a parent of very young children at the time, it literally took my breath away when people explained to me that they did not know where their children are, literally. And when we got into the details, what we would hear is that it was fairly common that people would, a woman would be detained as interior enforcement sort of increased as opposed to border enforcement. We started seeing more people being detained who had established families in this country, who had homes, and who were being picked up by either fugitive operations or by secure communities and other programs in the course of their regular daily activities. And so, for example, there would be someone who would tell us, well, I was picked up driving my car after dropping my children off at school, and I really haven't been able to have any communication with them since, and I don't know what's happening. So this was obviously of great concern to us, and we started bringing it up pretty much everywhere we went. And I can tell you that a lot of people were really annoyed hearing me talk about this issue for a very long time. But what's really fantastic, and I think this is a great example of this, is that ICE really began to listen. They started saying, you know, this is who they should contact if you're hearing this happen. And more it came to light that there really were things in the system that were not taking into account this reality. And therefore, there was this collateral damage of children being left behind in unsafe or uncertain situations. There were many reports that talked about what happened in the context of immigration raids and other enforcement activities, but we really decided to focus on how detention and deportation was affecting parental custody issues, because we were concerned that parents weren't able to make basic care arrangements for their children and were being prevented or weren't able to participate in family court proceedings, not because of an intentional obstruction, but because of the logistics of detention. So as we looked into this further and others started writing reports, I have to say that we need to acknowledge the help in working on this issue from many, many organizations across the country. The Florence Immigrant Rights Project really saw this happening on the ground in their area for a long time, gave us a lot of information, and really helped us develop some of these tools. Clinic has been working on this for ages and shared a lot of their information, and we were able to go back and forth and sort of develop best practices. Americans for Immigrant Justice was also in the forefront of sort of identifying the issue. As we worked on it, and Andrew will talk later about this, we really were able to work very, very closely with ICE to develop new policies or policy recommendations and directives to kind of help address the issue. But at the same time, we really felt that there was a lack of information for people in detention on what they could do to assert their rights, because very common at the beginning of this, when we started looking into this issue, was that ICE would say, well, nobody told us they had children. And people would say to me, well, I didn't even tell my immigration attorney because it's not an immigration matter. This is a child welfare matter. Or I didn't think anybody cared. I didn't think it was relevant. So we really thought it was important to make sure people understood they do need to tell somebody that this is an issue, because if they don't tell anybody, nothing can be done about it. So that's where the idea for the toolkit came out. And we really tried to create practical steps that people can take to make sure that their children are safe, to make sure that they can take their children with them if that's what they want and what's the best option, and to make arrangements if they can't take their children with them or if they're not going to be deported. I can tell you that this was very complicated. It's really simple to say at the beginning. We're like, oh, we'll just create a guide and we'll have, you know, 10 steps. Well, you know, we have 50 states and even more child welfare organizations or departments in this country. So it was not easy. And so you can see that what we came up with was this pretty hefty guide. A lot of this is appendices with sample forms, so don't be too frightened off by the size of it. And it is available in Spanish as well, which is obviously critical for this population. Just giving you a little bit of sense of numbers before I hand it over. When we first wrote our report on this, on the kind of where things stood 4 years ago in Torn Apart, we stated that there were over 5 million children in this country who had at least one undocumented parent, so who were at risk of having a parent or caretaker apprehended and deported. and over 3 million of those are U.S. citizen children. Since then, ARC did further research and found in 2011 that 5,100 children were in the foster care system because of a parent's detention or deportation. And they expected or predicted that based on the enforcement numbers of the time, which has stayed steady, that within 5 years there would be 15,000 children in the system. I'm hopeful that the policies that have been instituted since we began working with ICE on this have actually prevented that from happening. And while families are still separated, that hopefully children are not ending up in dangerous situations or in foster care because of that, that they're actually with caretakers that their parents have chosen or reunified with their parents. But it's difficult to know, and I think some of the MPI research may shed some further light on that. Regardless, it remains a very big problem. We know that still today, many, many people who are detained and deported have family members here in the country. So it remains a critical issue, and we hope that the toolkit will help people make arrangements for their children and prevent really unnecessary termination of rights, which is, of course, ultimately a critical concern for all of us.
Okay,
I'll hand it over.
We're going to go to the toolkit, and I think I got things turned around before. The next speaker is Emily Butera. She's going to take us through the toolkit, and then we'll go to Andrew.
Thanks, Emily. Doris. And I just wanted to start by noting that this toolkit had a lot of parents. as Michelle noted, it was quite a challenge to put together. And there were four authors in total, myself as well as Jessica Jones, who is in the room, and Dana Cho and Joanne Kelsey. So I do want to thank them for the time and effort that they put in, and also say thank you to the law firms of Steptoe and Johnson and Spears and Iams for their support, as well as the Oak Foundation and a lot of donors across the country who actually stepped up as part of a catapult campaign to help us bring the final product to production. So as Dora said, I will walk you through the toolkit. And as Michelle talked about, but I just want to emphasize, what happens a lot of times is that children are falling through the cracks and ending up in the child welfare system when their parents are detained and deported, really as a collateral consequence of enforcement. The immigration system is not set up to deal with child welfare matters. The child welfare system does not really understand the immigration system or communicate very well with it. And the result, as Michelle noted, can be prolonged family separation and also, in the most extreme cases, termination of parental rights. So the toolkit aims to get at those issues by giving detained and deported parents, but also the attorneys, advocates, community service organizations, friends and relatives who form the part of their support structure, to provide them with step-by-step instructions for the things parents can do to maintain their parental rights and to make well-informed decisions about the care and welfare of their children. So when you flip through the toolkit, you'll find information on things like making care arrangements for children at the time a parent is apprehended, finding out if a child is in the child welfare system and how to work with that system, helping parents comply with the family reunification plans that are put forth by the child welfare system as a precondition to family reunification, how to participate in family court when you're detained or deported, and how to try to reunify with your children, practically speaking, at the conclusion of your immigration case. It also contains, Michelle noted, a lot of appendices. Some of the things that I just want to highlight from those appendices is that they include contact information for state child welfare agencies in all 50 states, as well as links to state-specific handbooks for parents with children who are in the child welfare system. It also has guidance on requesting appointed counsel in family court, as well as instructions for applying for U.S. passports from your children if you are detained, and contact information for adoption reunion registries. So I don't have time, obviously, to walk through the entire document, but what I wanted to do was highlight some of the most important things that parents can do if they're picked up by immigration and they're worried about reuniting with their children. So first and foremost, we encourage parents to ask for help when they need it and to be their own advocate. And also, as Michelle noted, it's really critical that parents tell ICE at the time of apprehension that they have children. ICE does have policies and protocols in place to try to resolve some of these issues, but they only work if the agency is aware of the situation. Parents should ask to make a phone call at the time of apprehension to arrange care for their children. And if they don't get that phone call or they're still not confident about where their children are, they should ask again at the time they arrive at a detention center to make the phone calls that they need to find out where their children are. They can also ask ICE for prosecutorial discretion and ask to be released. Now, obviously, that's an individual decision on a case-by-case basis, as Andrew will talk about, but primary caregivers of minor children in the United States are a discretion priority, and parents need to know that an individual is a primary caregiver. We always tell parents, keep asking, and you never know where it might lead. We also advise that parents find a lawyer to help them with the family court process. Parents do have legal rights to their children, even when children are in the child welfare system, and a family lawyer can be instrumental in helping to protect those rights. Parents may also be entitled to court-appointed counsel in certain states to represent them in child custody proceedings. And if you look in the toolkit, Chapter 5 actually provides some information on how to go about finding a family attorney, and also which states provide that counsel for free. For children who are going to be in the community as opposed to in the child welfare system, parents might want to consider giving whoever they're living with some kind of formal permission to serve as caregiver. So that can include something a little bit less formal, like a power of attorney. Sometimes it's called a poder in the Latino community. But another option to consider is long-term legal guardianship. Now, that carries certain advantages and disadvantages, so we really do advise that parents consult with a family lawyer to understand what they're getting into in these sorts of situations. For parents who are in detention who don't know where their children are, the most important thing that they can do is try to find out if they're in the child welfare system. The child welfare timeline moves extremely quickly, and parents need to be engaged from early on in the process to increase the likelihood that they'll be able to reunify with their children. They can contact, or someone who is helping them can contact the local child welfare agency in the state where their children are living, not where the parent is detained, which might be different. They can also contact an organization called Child Help. That number is 1-800-4-A-CHILD. And they can connect you to the local child welfare entity in any jurisdiction in the country. It's also important, as parents are communicating with child welfare, that they're letting the child welfare system know where they're detained and how to communicate with them. So they need to provide information like their name, their date of birth, their country of birth, the address of the detention center where they're held, and their alien registration number. And if they're transferred to another detention center, it's really critical that the parent notify child welfare so that any documentation related to the child welfare case will ideally follow the parent wherever they're moved. Consulates of foreign countries can be extremely helpful in assisting parents both in working with ICE and the child welfare system and also figuring out how they will work the child welfare plan once they are returned to their home country. So for parents who are comfortable contacting their governments, we highly recommend that they do so. Obviously, staying in touch with children is critical, as well as staying in touch with the child welfare system and whoever is caring for their children. Visitation is an option. Andrew's going to talk a little bit more about that. But for parents for whom visitation is not possible, they can also call their children. They can write them letters. But all of these things are going to be really essential in proving to the child welfare system that that parent wants to reunify with their children and is capable of doing so. As I mentioned, the state will put in place a child welfare reunification plan. That's an entire list of things that a parent will need to do to get their child back. It can be very hard to work that plan from detention, but parents do need to try. They should be letting the system know everything that they're doing to participate in that plan. And if there are things that they can't do because they've been detained or deported, they can ask the child welfare system and the family court whether that plan can be modified in some way to make it easier to work. Part and parcel of that, obviously, is participation in family court proceedings. And again, the Parental Interest Directive, which ICE released last summer, does set forth mechanisms by which parents can request that ICE help them participate in family court proceedings. They can participate in person, but they can also participate by video or by telephone. It's really critical that when a parent gets notification of a court date that they show that documentation to ICE as soon as possible, because obviously that can be a little bit difficult to set up. For parents for whom deportation is imminent, they should be working with their child's caregiver to obtain all of the documents that would be necessary for their children to join them in their home country if that's what the family chooses as the best option. So that includes getting a passport for the child, a visa, a health record, school records. And parents obviously won't have the originals of those documents, but they should have copies sent to them. Parents also need to think about how they're going to coordinate either the long-term care of their children here in the United States post-deportation, or if they want to take their children with them, how that might be possible. If ICE is planning to remove a parent, they, under the directive, will do whatever they can do to try to help the parent make the arrangements as long as parental rights have not been terminated. So that may include helping a parent get access to the paperwork they need to get a passport, and up to and even considering whether there are ways to allow a family to leave the country together. Now, obviously, if a child is still in the child welfare system, it's child welfare's decision whether or not that child will be able to reunify with the parent. So for parents who are going to be removed and are in that situation, they really do need to make sure to communicate their wishes to the child welfare system. And lastly, parents need to remember that even if they're deported, the child welfare case does not conclude at the time of deportation. And so they will still need to participate in their reunification plan and participate in family court hearings from outside of the United States. If there is a hearing scheduled with regards to termination of parental rights, parents can ask the U.S. government for humanitarian parole to temporarily return to the U.S. in order to attend those hearings. And I think Andrew will probably talk a little bit more about that. So lastly, just to note, on your chair, in addition to the toolkit, are a couple of companion documents. We do know that the toolkit is quite lengthy and can be a little bit dense. So we've actually created what we're calling a brief guide to maintaining custody of your children. That's available in both English and Spanish, and it kind of lays out the tips that I've just put forth here. And also a safety planning document, what we're calling Making a Plan, Migrant Parents Guide to Preventing Family Separation, to help people who fear that they might be apprehended by immigration authorities think through what they might be able to do in advance to ensure family reunification at the end of a parent's immigration case. So the toolkit and those materials are all available for download on our website at womensrefugeecommission.org. And also there are extra copies of both English and Spanish versions of the toolkit in the hall. You're welcome to take them. And we've also prepared postcards that instruct people in where they can go to download the toolkit. It's in both English and Spanish. And if you'd like to take copies to distribute with your networks or for embassy folks who are here with the consulates, please help yourself and we can get you more if you need them. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Emily. That's a lot of issues. really gets you thinking. So, okay, Andrew, talk to us about the ICE side of this.
So, well, a lot of my thunder was stolen, but that's good.
Sorry. I didn't steal your biggest thunder.
That's true, not my biggest thunder. So, first and foremost, this is what happens when good government works with good stakeholders in the community. What we've done at ICE is listened. We started detention reform back in August of 2009, and we wanted to look at it from a wide spectrum and think outside the box. I myself am not an immigration attorney. I'm a child welfare attorney. So I did not think when I came to work for ICE that I would get back in the world of child welfare proceedings, but lo and behold, I am, and I'm doing this. I am the parental rights coordinator for the agency as well as leading a division at headquarters. So just a little bit more of context before I get into unveiling the provisions of the directive. So at any given day, there's 34,000 people in ICE detention. Most people probably know that, especially in this audience. However, tons of other folks are going what we call the non-detained docket. ICE has enforcement priorities, which you've probably heard about. First and chief among them are criminal offenders, are folks who have gone through the criminal justice system. Right now, if we could lump our population in detention into two camps, I would say half are what we call border arrivals. They have to be detained because of statutory provisions, because of their crossing. And the rest are what we call through our criminal alien program, or CAP. You've heard of secure communities. We are obviously working with institution proceedings like jails and prisons, et cetera. So a lot of the folks coming into detention, in terms of parents, are usually people who have come through the criminal justice system or are coming through the border. And so it's really not ICE that potentially put the child welfare proceeding in place. Oftentimes, if they're a re-border crosser, they may have been removed before, and they're seeking to be back with their families. They want to be, and I certainly there's an understanding of that, right? Also, in the criminal context, if people are going through criminal proceedings before, they're coming out from an incarcerated setting, that child welfare proceeding has already happened. So, while there is some debate about how much the detention and deportation plays into this, from my perspective, doing this and managing it day-to-day with the directive, about, I see a lot of the triggers of child welfare from those two main draws. Now, they're always one-offs, right? They're always different exceptions. So mainly, it's ongoing proceedings that had nothing to do with an ICE action. Now, obviously, ICE took an action to detain someone and put them through proceedings. That I'll give you. With regards to certain other reforms, before I get to the directive, it was key for ICE to understand who was going through our detention system, enforcement system. We want to do an active screening process, an active understanding of who is coming into the system, who we're releasing, who we're detaining, and base that upon risk. And one of the things we developed was the risk assessment tool, the RCA, risk classification instrument. And for the first time, we looked at immigration equities, criminal history, and humanitarian equities. Now, obviously, to this audience and today, one of the things we looked at is primary caregiver status. We asked them, are you a primary caregiver? We didn't make notion of gender norms or your mother or father. We asked, are you doing the day-to-day care of an individual? And primarily for us, it's not the monetary purpose, but it's who's feeding the child, who's doing shelter, who's providing for the day-to-day care of those individuals. So automatically, when we go through the risk assessment tool, we're going to screen to say, hey, are they doing their primary care status? Are they mandatory detention? Can we do a presumption of release based upon those humanitarian factors? And that's key because first amongst my staff is with that RCA instrument is to say, hey, and I know how hard it is to navigate the child welfare system, but imagine you have, you know, your pro se books for immigration, you got your pro se manuals for family law. A person is very like, oh my gosh, I'm in the two systems. How does this work? Obviously, it's in the best interest for ICE if they can do that, not in a detained setting. So that's what we try to do with our risk assessment tool. Going beyond that, we had our sets of immigration detention standards. We have three sets of immigration detention standards. The best and brightest of them was our performance standards of 2011. And we put in there, in different places, the ability to access your child with visitation provision, the ability to participate with escorts to family court. But what we found after working with some partners at the White House and with our stakeholders is there is not one-stop shopping. And in government, you want to have the best efficiency model as possible. We're doing 10,000 things. We want to say, this is the document you turn to. You look at it. If it's dealing with parents or kids, you look at this, and it kind of cross-references everything. And that was what the Parental Interest Directive was. It was our intent to have efficiency of government, to say, hey, we have prosecutorial discretion. We have these things in the standards. Let's catalog them, put them in one place. Let's also call for a national parental rights coordinator. Let's have parental interest coordinators each and every field to work with the stakeholders and the detained population. And let's have a provision that commits to working with groups like the Women's Refugee Commission to build tools like this. Because at the end of the day, ICE is not a welfare agency. It's an enforcement agency. But it's folks like the WRC and other Human Rights First and other types of stakeholders who do this good work. And we need to highlight it and give access to it. That's what we did. So the Parental Rights Directive, which is something I was very, very proud to do. I'm very proud of this. It calls for many of the things that you've already mentioned. So placement. When we have to detain someone based upon statutory obligation, based upon our priorities, we're going to seek to put that person near their family. If we know about their child welfare proceedings, we're going to try to put them near to them. We're going to try to make sure that there's visitation if they have to be detained. Not only visitation with their family members, but by the social workers if they're doing these plans that Emily mentioned. We want to make sure they have access to the court. And my staff works day in and day out with a myriad of different organizations because child welfare is done almost at the county level. And you're seeing different types of biases, different types of approaches to this. There's a different understanding when it comes to immigrant detainees. We try to correct the record, if you will, about what they're there for. It's not a punitive measure, immigration detention. The term criminal alien is misunderstood in the general vernacular, so we try to correct that. And so we want to make sure they can participate in those court proceedings. We will ensure that all law libraries are not only outfitted with immigration materials, but child welfare materials. We also have put up, since DACA announced the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, we had a call center for DACA screening, which under my former office, the Office of Public Advocate, I was in charge of. That call center we turned into the detainee helpline. And any given day in our detention, you can pick up the phone and you can access one of my operators. And if you want to ask about parental rights issues, child separation issues, we will ensure we get those equities and brought them to attention so we can act upon them. Because in practicality, when someone's first going through detention, they're very resonant to talk about where their kids are, right? You're the enforcer. You just picked me up. I'm in detention. Why do I want to tell you about this? And so it's a slow building of rapport and of understanding, letting them know that you work with people like Emily and Michelle, that that we want to do the right thing when it comes to the best interest of the child. And so this call center allows us to get actual information. We also have good data systems at our disposal. So my staff will look at who's in detention and call upon if there's equities like family members or if there's other triggers. We work with our local field coordinators to ensure that those things are triggered and that we act upon them. On the rare occasion, and I want to make sure this is understood, and we're not in the business of bringing people back, but on the rare occasion, the directive does say we will offer humanitarian parole for people to come and make sure they can defend for themselves their parental interests. And that's what that's the right thing to do. And of course, we're going to seek alternative means to facilitate that. We worked extraordinarily with so many high-profile cases with the Mexican government, with the consular officials there. We're continuing to do that with my senior advisor for parental interest to bring folks back when they need to be here so they can take part in the hearings. They will be placed usually on a form of ATD to be allowed for them to take part in the hearings. So that's very, very important to understand. So what you should know as the takeaway from ICE's perspective, one, the directive was a kind of a call together of reforms already started back in 2009, that ICE is committed to looking at this issue from its different equity standpoint, and that this is a good day when there is one thing, one toolkit, where the detained population can go to get information, but also know that from your perspective, the government is working with vested stakeholders to make this flow happen and to allow for persons who find themselves navigating two very complex and stressful situations that we're here to advocate for those parental interests in the course of immigration enforcement. Oh, good. So another big announcement. That's why we thought my big thunder was. Big thunder is this toolkit in all of its copious amounts is in all of our law libraries, not just in hard form, because in hard form they tend to disappear, but it's in a searchable PDF in our law library computers. Not only that, for the better part of about 6 months, we've had the kind of easy to understand flyer circulating in our housing affairs. And I'm proud to report that this is in the law libraries, it's being utilized, we have a great information exchange with our call center. We're not in the business of giving child welfare advice, but we do put people in contact with the right folks. So that's a big, big achievement, and we're very, very happy about it.
Very interesting. Thank you, Andrew. I have to pause at this time, based on Andrew's comments, to recognize Phyllis Coven, who's in the audience. Many of you may know Phyllis. If you don't, you should. She's now the director of the USCIS office in New York, but was at ICE in the years that Andrew is describing, heavily responsible for and engaged in this effort, particularly the risk assessment tool. So it must be very satisfying to you to see this evolution. Very, very nice to have you here. Thank you. Let me now turn also to my colleague, Sarah, because we'll add just a few pieces of information to the issue that Michelle talked about a little bit at the outset, which has to do with the numbers of parents in this country. This comes from research that we are doing on the impact on children who are U.S. citizen children when their parents, one or more, have been deported. So fill in those numbers, and then we're going to come back to Emily.
Great. Thanks, Doris. Hi. I'm Sarah Hooker with Migration Policy Institute, and as Doris mentioned, MPI has been working with a team actually from the Urban Institute for about the past 18 months or so on a project that's actually funded by Health and Human Services, HHS, the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, ASPE, and this project has been looking at the impact of parents' deportation or detention on U.S. citizen children. And we did, as part of a team with MPI and the Urban Institute, throughout spring 2013 and fall 2014, site visits in five different locations across the U.S. We were in the Lower Rio Grande Valley, in L.A., Miami, Chicago, and South Carolina. And in these site visits, talked to child welfare providers, talk to health and human service providers about the impacts on family members who are left behind when a parent is detained or deported. But we also visited detention facilities, and three of these site visits were actually after the Parental Interest Directive had just been introduced. So that was great because we were able to see kind of the initial implementation of that directive and information sharing with the field officers at the time. And we were able to interview some detainees who are were parents, both male and female detainees, some of whom were primary caregivers and some of whom were, were also caregivers, and did talk a lot about the financial impact as well as the emotional impacts and sort of the housing instability and everything that can result in this process. But in any case, I know that Randy was going to give you all a quick highlight of that research, which is not out yet, and we can't tell you exactly when it will be out because it's going through a review process right now with ASPE and with ICE, but we will be excited to provide that. In terms of the numbers that Doris had mentioned, we do estimate that there's been about 90,000 parents deported per year over the past several years. That may have gone down slightly since the overall number of deportations went down in 2013, but we still estimate that it falls somewhere in the 75,000 to 100,000 range. And I think then our estimate would be that overall, that the average parent who's deported has approximately two children along the same size of families of U.S. families. And so I think that the information I have from Randy says, so we've been expecting then that there would be approximately 150,000 to 200,000 children per year affected by a parent's deportation. That includes USC and non-USC children. So in any case, I'm very happy to talk to you more in the Q&A or follow up with you afterwards if you'd like to learn more about the study and kind of, and the data we're still working on, working with ICE on some data requests. And, you know, there's a lot of that that we'll have to say stay tuned, but we'll be excited to share more when we have it. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sarah. All right, Emily to the Hill.
Yes, thank you. And I'll be brief. You've heard a lot from me already. But we had hoped to have Senator Franken and Congresswoman Roybal Allard with us here today. Unfortunately, things are really busy on the Hill, and they weren't able to join us. But I really do want to acknowledge the tremendous leadership that they have shown in trying to resolve the third piece of this puzzle, which is really the need for legislative reforms to codify the good practices that we've been able to do administratively and what we're promoting through education. So there are two pieces of legislation that have been moving through Congress, or in Congress, rather, since 2009. One is the Help Separated Children Act. The other is the Help Separated Families Act. So a little confusing in that they have the same name. The Help Separated Children Act really takes on the issue from the DHS side of things, tries to put in place enforcement and detention policies to reduce the likelihood that parents will be detained and children will end up in the system, but also to codify many of the things that the Parental Interest Directive would do. That legislation was actually included in the immigration reform bill that passed the Senate last summer. Interestingly, I think very encouragingly, it was introduced as an amendment in the Senate Judiciary Committee by both Senators Franken and Grassley, and it was the only amendment that passed the Judiciary Committee unanimously. So that shows we've got tremendous bipartisan support to resolve the issue. It has also been introduced several times in the past in the House, and we do expect to see it introduced there soon. And the Help Separated Families Act, which tackles the issue from the HHS side of things, the effort is really to try to minimize the likelihood that child welfare practice will lead to termination of parental rights by doing things like allowing child welfare agencies to consider detention and deportation as an appropriate reason to delay termination of parental rights, and making sure that immigrant parents who are detained and deported really do have a full opportunity to participate in the process of working the reunification plan and attending family court. That legislation was also included in the Senate Immigration Reform Bill and has also been introduced as a standalone legislation in the House of Representatives. So I do hope that regardless of what happens with immigration reform, we might see some traction on this issue in the months and years to come.
good rundown on a broad, broad range of issues and intersecting systems. So I see people in the room that are engaged in these issues from a number of the standpoints that have been talked about. So we have some time now for Q&A, and I'm happy to recognize whoever might want to either comment or ask a question. Marjorie, I'll wait a minute for the mic to come up. And tell us your name and affiliation.
Oh, that's a complicated one. It changes. I'm Marjorie Zatz. I'm this week at Arizona State University, but in 2 weeks going to be at University of California, Merced. And I have a book coming out with University of California Press called Dreams and Nightmares, Immigration Policy, Youth and Families. And so I was lucky. I got to see the toolkit early. Michelle and Emily were very gracious about letting me look at it, and it's absolutely wonderful, and so congratulations on that. My question, aside from lots of accolades on that, is for Andy and perhaps for Sarah. So we have this wonderful parental interest directive. To what extent is it being implemented in the field? What are the kinds of challenges that you've encountered, and how might the toolkit help with that? And I guess if I can follow that up, I'm particularly interested in situations where you've got someone who's a parent, but they also may have a minor criminal offense. So how are things being balanced in the field?
So that's a question we get, obviously, all the time, because what happens a lot in Washington is you have this nice rhetoric on a page, and they're like, well, what happens with the practicality of things? I feel the proof is what I have, what I've seen with my data. So I have a team that's directed to help with this. I have a team at headquarters, but I have 24 parental interest coordinators in the field. And they're at the assistant field office director level. So it's their job to ensure that there's implementation in the field. And we've been doing a set of trainings. In fact, our next set of training, not only on the directive, already happened, but we're working with the American Bar Association's Family Law Division to do a whole training with the officers and our leadership in the field on the child welfare proceedings and how that system all works. So it's great to have a toolkit for the parents, but I need a toolkit for my officers and my trial attorneys as well. What's key about this is our ability to know from the risk assessment tool the data in real time. I'm able to know as they process through who people who identify as a primary caregiver, I'm able to see that data, and the field and I have worked out a relationship where we push out these cases and say, if this case hasn't been set for release, is this a case we can look at for release? Is this a case where we need to ask more questions based upon there's been, you know, some time in the facility if they have to be mandatorily detained? Ask them again about their parental interest equity so we can ensure that they're going to court, they can, the visitation, et cetera. I can tell you that from my perspective, because we operate a call center that's open not only to the detainees but to the family law attorneys and the immigration attorneys, when people bring these lines of interest about prosecutor's discretion and the parental interest directive, we're seeing it's working. We're seeing that we're looking at the fact patterns. We're making informed decisions. Now, unfortunately, our population tends to be 72% mandatory. So a lot of these aren't decisions for us to make. There's another place that does that, a big white Capitol building that sets that rules up. So these are very, of the discretionary decisions, it's very few for ICE to make. In addition, there might be a chance we actually will work with a lot of different partners to see if we can release from detention once we've ascertained some things, and then there will be release out of detention after some days in the community on all terms of detention, and so that happens quite frequently as well. So a lot of the times our hands are bound by some of the statutory framework, but I will tell you that from my perspective, we put in control mechanisms to allow for data to be flown to Washington, to our coordinators in the field offices, and for the field to understand these issues. And we've set up tons of different training and other ways that we can get this to be actionable.
Great, and I can also comment on that a little bit too. Although, of course, it's important to keep in mind that our site visits were pretty soon after it had been implemented. We were actually in LA, I believe, 3 weeks after the announcement of the directive. So, exactly, exactly. There were some other site visits further on into the fall as well. But But I think, you know, we heard definitely the initial reaction from field officers from the detention centers that this just codifies existing practice, you know, that we were doing a lot of these best practices already. We heard some things that the field offices thought would be challenging to implement and probably have had some challenges figuring out. Could be things around visitation, around transportation to child welfare proceedings. Visitation also partly because of just the large geographic distances involved in some of these areas. And same thing with the placement of parents, ideally near their children or near their child welfare proceedings. We heard, you know, for instance, that especially if it's a mother who's being detained, there just aren't as many detention facilities in a region that hold women. So that's just a lot harder. So those are definitely very practical challenges that I'm sure that ICE is working out as you go with this. But in terms of sort of the effectiveness, though, of something like the toolkit, I mean, I think we did see that the law libraries already have a lot of great resources in them even before this, but that we did hear a lot about sort of the onus being on the detainee themselves to navigate the system and how challenging that can be, especially since, you know, let alone... lack of English proficiency is one thing, but also lack of basic literacy, computer skills in a lot of cases. So I think we did have really have people stress to us sort of the importance of that's where the advocacy community has to step in and really and be able to be active partners. And that's where the legal services community has to help as well, because there's, you know, the detention facilities don't have the ability to be providing the child welfare case law assistance. In that way, but sure, there's absolutely a huge appetite for the kind of information that's in this guide. I think it's terrific.
Working with EOIR to include information about this in the legal orientation presentations that are available at many facilities, and that's obviously critical for getting the word out in a very practical way to the people in detention. And they've been very interested and cooperative on that, so it's just a matter at this point of the logistics.
Okay, other questions or comments? Yes.
Hi, thanks. Mark Nofri from the Immigration Policy Center. So, Andrew, a question for you. You mentioned the ability to attend family court proceedings while in detention. So if I can ask you about the ICE standard. So my understanding is that I think it's Section 5.2 of VA that provides for this. And it's there, but the ICE standards, yeah. It's there, but very restricted. So they're termed as emergency requests to attend, among other things, a family-related state court proceeding. The approval has to be at the field office director level, although it can be delegated to an assistant FOD for detainees who do not require a high degree of control and supervision. It has to be no less than two escorts. So a couple of questions. One, do you have any stats about how often these are used, you know, how many requests are made, how many are granted. Two, has there been any discussion as you've gone through this process, doing this great work about maybe loosening this standard and comparing it to what happens in the criminal system, you know, or just doing a more, you know, just asking for a furlough as happens in the criminal system or as the ABA immigration detention civil standards do. You know, if, as you say, immigration detainees are a different population and possibly less dangerous, could this be something that's looked at even further?
Well, a couple things. So the directive, I would call your attention to the directive, because the directive took what's in the language and the standards and added to it, and it was much broader. And that was called for in the directive to be a little bit broader, as you say. So we've already done part A to your question, so that's good. As to is this working, is this happening? First, the numbers, there aren't that many folks who are, to the high degree of numbers, transversing both systems where they have active ongoing child welfare proceedings. Now, it means that even if there's one or two, that's important, but it's not a huge cry of a large majority of our population who's doing both systems at the time. So in terms of getting a process in place where we're counting them, that's not happening, because every time there is an instance, I know about it because we've trained our field. that anytime the directive is provisions triggered, Nathan, who's sitting right next to you, is in charge of the weekly call to your right or your left or whatever. So he is in charge of talking to all the parental interest coordinators and all those things that come up. We think outside the box. And I will tell you, our biggest hurdle is not the ICE side. It's the child welfare side. And two persons down for you is Liz, who's from the Casey Foundation, my new fellow for parental interest. And she's helping me work to do the outreach to the child welfare proceedings court system and to the attorneys, because we're confronting biases on their end. There is very much a resistance to work with this population. The judges oftentimes don't want to potentially have the participation of the family member. There may be a proceeding in place with adoption they want to see to have go forward. It's hard for ICE to navigate this because we are not a social welfare agency. It's not for us to give legal advice. What we want to do is get the parent to have their best foot forward, to have them armed either with pro se or with toolkits like this or with attorneys, and get them in front of the court. But I will tell you that when it comes to ICE working to get them there, I see no hurdles with this. Yes, it's an escort. We're very much we do this all the time. Again, we deal with the criminal justice population, so we're already bringing people to court for those purposes. This is something we can handle. We have the infrastructure to handle it. We're doing it. It's just the receptiveness to have. Remember, these are like little fiefdoms, these child welfare. I mean, I worked in LA County, which is, I figured, one of the best, and that was hard in and of itself. So the hard parts aren't at the ICE end, from my perspective. Obviously, I work for ICE, but is for the at the child welfare side of the house, working with them, have them understand this population, what detention means, why they're there, what's the consequence, it's civil versus criminal. That understanding, that outreach is something we're trying to do. We've partnered with HHS, which has been the call by the White House to do that, and it's something we continue to do with American Bar Association and other NGOs to do that.
And I will just add, to build on Andrew's point, ICE is sort of in the line of fire here today, but there are problems on both the DHS and the HHS side of this issue. I mean, we have seen documented cases where family courts have terminated parental rights based solely on the fact that a parent is undocumented, although the law does not allow that to be the sole reason for terminating someone's parental rights. And so we are continuing to work with HHS as well as with DHS to try to put in place policies and procedures on that end of things to reduce the bias and as well as to train family courts on the rights of parents who are in detention and the processes that they can follow to allow them to participate. It's a little bit trickier. Because while DHS can send directions down to their field, HHS can issue guidance to state child welfare agencies, but they cannot mandate those agencies very easily to do anything. They can kind of make it contingent upon receipt of federal reimbursement for foster care services, but it is a little bit more complex. In a perfect world, we would have created a toolkit also to explain the immigration system to the child welfare system. So if anybody would like to fund that, I will volunteer the Women's Commission to take that on.
A little thicker and a little heavier. Others? Yes. Just a second, we'll bring you a mic.
Good afternoon. I am Stacey Ann Green. I'm from the Embassy of Jamaica. My question is to Mr. Stroth. Earlier you mentioned an arrangement with Mexico. That's regarding a humanitarian effort where parents are brought back to attend court hearing. Is this arrangement extended to other nationals, please?
Again, because the directive, this was a case that happened right as the directive got pushed out, a very high-profile case out of North Carolina. As the former public advocate, I'd worked a lot with the different consular officials and embassy officials to make sure that people understood ICE, its policies and procedures. That case, we worked with the Mexican consular officials, but it is open to everyone. We have policies and procedures. You'll see a fact sheet on the directive in your chairs. Our website is updated with facilitation of return requests and how those happen. It's a process. Obviously, the directive gives full attention to the layered process because obviously we need to make sure there's different protections in place and other things. But that's open to any nationality, any person who's been repatriated, who may need to come back to participate in the termination of parental rights hearing, those last stages of hearings before their parental rights are are terminated, we will work with those individuals. We've done Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, our typical top five countries, but we're not close to anyone in terms of working with a different official. So I can give you my card and we can talk offline.
Andrew, I think in your presentation you said that that while that's the case, it happens in a reasonably small number of circumstances, and that the first option is to try to do it, you know, from afar. What does that mean?
So again, this is also working with the court's perspective. So, you know, ICE is obviously in the business a lot of working with immigration appeals when they're going in front of the district court, the court of appeals, even the Supreme Court. But when it comes to working with child welfare proceedings, it's, you know, and having practiced under child welfare proceedings, judges are on their own little way about things, and, you know, they want to have a person here or not here. And so to work with a population who may not be in the courtroom is something that we try to see if we can do, because if we can do it by telephone or video, that's the preference of the agency, because that lessens certain exposure to us, you know, bringing back the extraordinary effort humanitarian parole does take. So we do try to work with the court on this, and when we're doing
it's basically phone or video.
Correct. Video or phone, and the directive calls for that to say, try to see if you can navigate these first, and if you can't, we'll look to see if we have to do bring you back in person.
So that's if the judge if the child
welfare. So there has to be a request from the court for the individual to come back for it to be granted. And we don't need, unlike sometimes family law courts or dependency courts aren't used to like writs, so to speak. So we work with different types of documentation to satisfy the requirements in the directive.
Okay, final question or comment? All right, well, in that event, let me congratulate the Women's Refugee Commission and the authors and instigators of this report. It really is a very inventive and thought-provoking effort in terms of the issues. Thank you very much, Andrew, for being a good example of good government stakeholder collaboration. And as you've said, this is most certainly a great example of that. And let me thank you all for coming and invite you to come forward and share other comments and questions if you'd like, as well as help yourselves to any refreshments. Thanks very much.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.